You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is
I Will Make You a Millionaire, another episode helping someone reach their goal of making millions. So, as you know, I've been helping people on their path to become millionaires. A lot of people are very creative, but they haven't done necessarily business before. They haven't made $1 million yet, so they need to learn those skills. So I am sort of teaching them how to think about what it takes to make $1 million, all the possibilities that are in front of you and all the creativity that's possible. But I have to say, I am learning probably even more than they're learning, because everybody I talk to is in a different industry. So I get to learn, like for instance, today is Jason First. He wants to build up in the restaurant industry, whether it means owning a restaurant or, as we discovered, alternatives to that. But I've been learning so much about the restaurant business, and I hope he's learning about how to make a million. But you could judge for yourself, and we'll see over the course of the next year. But here's Jason on his quest for millions. So quietly, Jay is going to become like the first time Jay plays chess, he's going to beat like every all master. Yeah.
So, the underdog, you know? Hey.
Get all the lessons. Do you not play at all, Jay?
I know how to play, but I'm not like tactics and opening. I just play for fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I think this lesson was good, because I think I've been thinking a lot about blunders. But I think the relationship between blunders and strategic plans is more important than I realize. And thinking in terms of these long-range strategic plans, as well as, like, I like the way you're thinking with, hey, let's set up as many accents as possible. That's the way I like to play. And but when it's in conjunction with a strategic plan, there's almost no chance to blunder when that's happening.
Right.
Or it's hard.
I also found my level of exhaustion has a direct correlation with the amount of blunders I make.
Yeah. And even and even calculation, it creates exhaustion. So if you can make moves that fit in with, you know, well-known plans or well-thought-out plans, you don't have to calculate as much, and you can save that energy for later in the game when it's time to destroy the opponent. You just want to make sure you don't blunder, but the more you're thinking in terms of plans, the less chance to blunder.
Yeah. I've been blundering a lot lately, so
you know. Me too. Everybody.
Strategic. Like,
there are some days I blunder, and I'm like, "What the fuck is going on? I just lost 200 rating points in blunders." And then other days I don't blunder, and it's just random. We're playing faster chess than a long range chess, so you're gonna blunder more.
Yeah, I mean, I was in restaurants for like 14 hours yesterday, so I got home and I was playing those games at like 1, because I'm obsessed with chess and I think about it all day long while I'm working. And I'm like, get home. I need to get a little bit of chess in and just play stupid.
Well, that game was a good game. That's why I'm saying, you know, I wouldn't even worry so much about, and I know this is easy for me to say because I don't follow this advice, but I wouldn't worry so much about the loss when you're learning good strategic things and you played you know, I find when I first start playing, let's say I lose a game, that I was winning. I'm like, okay, that was fine. I was playing a 2300 and I came up with a good plan that I now know, and I was winning, but I lost at the end, whatever. Then the second game, okay, same thing. Third game, what the? Fourth game, yeah. Robin, did something happen to my IQ? Am I going crazy? And
yeah.
I have to remember too that, you know, in the long run, the goal is to just be have a better understanding of chess, and then the ratings will come when that happens, no matter what.
Right. My dad always, he says, oh, I can't, I'm like, just play more games against real people. And he's like, oh, I just can't take the losing, which I don't mind losing. I more mind making stupid mistakes that I know better. You know, it's about me, not about my opponent. So if I get outplayed, I have no problem with that. I feel like I learned something. That's amazing. That's really what I'm doing it for anyway. But yeah, I play my 1 minute.
Okay. So yeah, how's, let me take out my notes from last week.
Yeah. Thank you again for taking the time and, I was rereading the transcript and thought it was weird listening to myself.
So I thought all these ideas were really good, and there's so many different directions. Like, we started going over all the different spokes to the restaurant wheel, as opposed to just owning a restaurant or consulting. But like, what did it make you think?
So, I mean, I think that I was really kind of, the part that I took away most, I guess, was like the who are you, what are you, and kind of like why now?
Yeah.
And I guess most specifically, I've been thinking about the why now part. Mm-hmm. Although, because I kind of know like who I am, I think feel pretty good about that. Like my skill set and like all the things I've learned over the last 7 years. The vision, I'm always a little bit up in the air about in terms of my focus, I guess, if that makes sense. That's kind of like choosing the spoke, right? I mean, is that...
Yeah, and it's also partly not just choosing the spokes, but naming them. So let's say you have a technique you use in chess and it seems to work. If you don't, like, for instance, what I call the harassing the queen strategy. There's no book or chapter or about harassing the queen strategy. It's just something I made up. But now that I've put a label to it, I can identify it more easily when it happens. Like in that one game I showed you that I played, I knew instantly I was going to play the harass the queen strategy. Whereas if I had never labeled that in my mind, even though I might have played it before, it would have been harder for me to decide to do it or recognize it. And so sometimes when you just label the spokes, you realize, oh, I have more, there's more options. And so the why now becomes easier because you just need to fulfill any of the spokes.
Right. So I guess like that was really helpful. And I guess I had been thinking about it a little bit leading up to our conversation about, you know, how I wanted to, you know, own my own restaurant. That had been my goal for so long. But to kind of recognize that there's actually all these other parts of this industry that I've, you know, acquired a bunch of skills and have, you know, kind of mastered at least some parts of it and want to continue to learn, obviously, on all of it.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you said you mastered all these skills or learned all these skills. Clearly, restauranting is not a skill. But what are all the micro skills that makes up a good restaurateur? I don't know. So I'm just asking out of curiosity.
Yeah. So I guess, there's tons, but, you know, specifically like product knowledge is always a good start, I would
say. How to make good food
or knowledge about like different types of cooking techniques and, you know, different cuts of meat and, how flavors typically work together, with, you know, beverage, you know, craft cocktail skills, you know, so, maybe so I this can't.
This is kind of like like you say, the product is ultimately what's the restaurant serving. So this is almost like bordering on this micro skill of restauranteuring is overlaps with cooking skills.
Yeah. And a little bit too of like, it's like your arsenal of weapons to sell. And so the more you know about which weapons you want to use at which times, the better you are.
Like, what's an example? Like, is that like a Valentine's Day? What's the dinner being
served?
No,
so I think the best example of that is, so let's say your check average is $100, which is like at a nice restaurant, right? Like, so per person, you're roughly at $100 per person. One of the things I love to tell when I was managing, to tell other servers, and now when I'm serving, I like to use myself. If I can figure out a way to sell a dessert drink, right? A port or an Amaro, you know? And if I can speak on it, like, oh, hey, you just had a great Italian meal. You want to finish it off the traditional Italian way with a nice digestif, maybe an Amaro? And they're like, you know, they don't know about it. If I can tell them about it, sell it to them. And then that's 10% extra on their bill. You know, it's a $10 drink. So I just improved my check average by 10%, and I improved my tips by 10%.
So this is different from, so it's interesting. Knowledge of cooking is different than what a chef needs to know. Knowledge of cooking from a restaurateur's point of view is different than knowledge of cooking from a chef's point of view, because you're intersecting it with the knowledge about what the check means.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, chefs can know that you put this really weird type of pork, like, or you put the chicken neck in a chicken stock, and that's what gives it the most flavor. I'm not telling a single guest that, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because nobody wants to hear about chicken neck at the table.
Right.
Some people do, but I do, but not the majority of people. So it's totally different. And, you know, I know the buzzwords to hit to make us, and it's all true, you know?
So what's interesting there is just you speaking about this, this creates another spoke even, which is, imagine software that compares check with meal with menu and uses kind of AI-based training from experts like yourself to suggest sales techniques or to suggest what this, you know, to suggest product plus words to use to kind of upsell to make the check higher.
Yeah.
That's a legit software package.
Yeah, or like a newsletter, you know, type of thing too.
Yeah.
Like one of the more micro.
So it creates more newsletters.
We talked about.
So what's another skill? So there's product knowledge, understanding timing.
Timing for sure. Yeah. You know, in terms of reservation turns, in terms of desirability of the meal, like, you don't, if you go out to a dinner with a friend, you don't want to be there for 4 hours, right? Like, you want to be there for an hour and a half to 2 hours. And is that what you meant?
Yeah. Yeah. So basically seating knowledge, like, you know, in different situations, the seat is going to be taken up for different amounts of time.
Yeah. And I mean, timing across the board, like knowing how long, you have to fire, you know, if you have a first course, you have to tell the kitchen to start working on the second course. When do you do that? You know, Do you do that when they're done with their course, or should you do that 5 or 10 minutes before they're done with their course?
Yeah.
Right. And it's different for every type of cuisine, you know, so I can tell you to cook a 8-ounce filet medium rare, it'll take about 20 minutes on a wood fire grill, or 15 minutes, because you need to rest it, you need to put it back on, flash it, you know. So there's all sorts of stuff there.
What's another micro skill?
I would say staffing is a big one. So knowing how many people you need on any given night, you know, there's most restaurants will take walk-ins, and it can be inconsistent at times. So you have to kind of ride that line where you don't want people to be bored and not making money, but you also don't want people to be over, you know, stretched too thin.
So walk-ins are walk-ins for work?
Walk-ins, like we call people that don't make reservations. So if you were like, hey, you know, last minute, I kind of want to go check out this restaurant, I'll just go there and show up and see if I can get in without a reservation.
Right.
We call that a walk-in. And so depending on where you're at, like, it can be really inconsistent, especially if you're not fully booked every night. If you are fully booked every night, then it's sometimes, you know, maybe you don't take any walk-ins at all.
Right.
But that's, I've worked at both places that are at full capacity every single night, no matter what. And also places that have empty tables on most nights.
And then
it's harder to manage the empty tables on most nights restaurants than it is the full ones.
How important is the list of influential people, you know, like building a network, having a skill of building a network, so you know that you can get people into the restaurant?
I mean, I personally think it's huge. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of debate about that, I would say. Boca Lupo, the Italian restaurant where I'm serving right now, they don't care quite as much mm-hmm. about that because they book, you know, a month in advance, pretty much, you know, fully booked out a month in advance. Most of the people that I see are not regulars that keep coming back. Mm. There are people that have been wanting to try this restaurant for a while and finally have been able to get in.
What will happen when everybody who wants to try out that restaurant has tried out the restaurant?
It might take a while, but that's a good question. It's pretty small. So it's like, and it's pretty, I don't know. It's pretty, I mean, we definitely have people that come back over and over again, mostly bar regulars, mostly in those kind of the first come first serve type of seating areas, which are very small. And a lot of people, you know, I tried to get somebody in last week and I was having a lot of trouble doing it. Cause we were fully committed and, you know, they're not the type of people that are just going to show up, you know, they want to come in and have a reservation, have a nice meal, and be guaranteed that they're going to get a table when they walk in the door.
Yeah.
And then there's other people that are like, I just want to eat there tonight. I'll wait 45 minutes outside with a drink in my hand and wait for a table to open up and hope for the best. And if not, there's plenty of other stuff in walking distance where I know I can get food.
And then I guess there must be some skill in inventory management.
Yeah, inventory management is a big one. You know, pricing strategies is something I was pretty invested in when.
Menu design or format?
I would definitely not say I'm an expert in that.
But is it a skill?
It is a skill for sure. Mm-hmm.
And what about maitre d'ing?
Maitre d'ing, as in seating like tables?
Or being able to be the face of the restaurant.
Yeah, so that's definitely a skill I have. You know, I think that's like a twofold. So one is, you know, if a table walks in at 5:45 and I need a table back by 7 o'clock, that's the only table I could possibly put them at. Do I take the risk? You know, I look deep into their soul and see if they're going to be there for an hour and 15 minutes or going to be there for 2 hours. Do I ever say I need the table back?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like to do that as much.
Yeah.
But I will in extreme situations where I'm like, look, I can get you, but you got to have the table back in an hour and 15, go sit at the bar afterwards. You know, I just really need that table back in an hour and 15 minutes. I don't love saying that just because I don't want them to feel rushed. I want them to, you know, be in and out, but yeah, I've done that before for sure.
And then what other micro skills might be in restaurateuring? I guess picking a location for a restaurant.
Yeah. Which I have no experience in whatsoever, but I think I have some good ideas about it. You know, there's the financial analysis.
Okay. All right. So I just wanted to kind of list some of those. And so, yeah, so we were talking about the why now.
Yeah. So that was really what like got me thinking. And you mentioned, you know, Open Table exists and will exist and has existed. And, you know, reservation system. You know, there's part of me that's like, okay, the why now for that is because there's a lot fewer tables in a lot of restaurants. So it's becoming a little bit of an exacerbated problem. But I don't know how temporary that is. So
even if it wasn't temporary, though, even if it was temporary, it's still something that, you know, many restaurants deal with.
Right. But more specifically, I think, like, the more I think about it, the more the problem of hiring has become, is like a really big, you know, in the present moment.
So let's talk about that for a second. Or first, why do you think that?
There was so much talk about, you know, restaurants are all going to die, you know, and a lot of them have, and especially in certain cities. But I took why now to mean like why now and why here. Mm-hmm. So when I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking a lot about Atlanta.
Yeah.
And what happened was, at the start of COVID, I'll tell you my experience. So at the start of COVID, I had just been in New York. I saw what was happening. I went to the owner of my restaurant group. I said, look, we need to pivot. Let's do it. Spinning wheels for a long time, nothing happened. And I was getting, you know, I got emotional about it, which I shouldn't have done, but I did. And I felt what was coming, and it was hard for me to separate, you know, my livelihood and my friends and coworkers' livelihoods. And so right when we closed, the owners told me I had to put everybody on furlough. So I called everybody and, you know, told them, hey, look, you kind of have a job here. You kind of don't. I don't know what to tell you. I'm so sorry. We're not going to be paying you anymore. You know, we're going to apply for unemployment for everybody. Hopefully the government's going to come through. It was really, you know, back then, nobody knew what was going on.
Right.
And so
did you guys set up a GoFundMe for the employees?
I had some cool ideas that I didn't get approval on. It was a hard time for me.
Yeah.
I was feeling like I had all these, like, I was feeling nervous a little bit, but I was also feeling like very encouraged because I thought the industry needed a shakeup. And I thought that there was like a lot of really great opportunities coming. The owner of the restaurant ended up doing like $100,000 in gift cards that he gave to the staff. And so it was about $1,000 per person. It was still a very nice gesture for sure. But $1,000, that's what, you know, my bartenders were making that in 3 or 4 days. So
yeah,
it wasn't a ton. And a lot of my employees, you know, weren't approved for various reasons for unemployment.
Wow. You
know? So, I mean, anybody that's not an American citizen struggles.
Yeah, I wonder how do they survive?
They always survive. They pick up odd jobs. They save better than most servers. Even though they don't have as high paying jobs, they always have a cushion, a little bit at least.
Because they don't want to take they know how to take the risk a little better.
Yeah, I mean, and also they send money back home a lot of times. So I don't know. It's just, they also have that more of like the hustler mentality, generally speaking. You know, I know this one guy, Javier, who I love dearly. I shout him out in my resume for teaching me how to carry a lot of plates. Him and his wife, Maria, from the first day I ever started working in restaurants, they took me under their wing, and I speak very poor Spanish, but I try a little bit, and I love them. You know, like they call me their baby, and they're little. They're a couple years older than me, but I was like, they wanted to teach me everything they knew. And that is their hospitality more than most, even though they don't speak great English. They want to take care of people. They want to serve people.
And they
work so hard.
You just reminded me too, waiter skills are obviously an important micro skill.
Oh, I mean, we just scratched the surface, really.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many different little skills that you kind of pick up along the way, and some are more important than others, but they all kind of complete the whole picture of hospitality, I guess. When all that was unfolding, essentially everybody got put on furlough across the whole city. There was no game plan about, hey, we're going to open up. Hey, your jobs are going to come back. Like, who we're going to rehire. There was nothing going on. There was a lot of talk about maybe we're going to shut down. maybe we're going to open and be unsafe. Like, what capacity can we do? It was just so, the uncertainty level was through the roof. I had employees that were in nursing school that were, you know, had a second job. They, you know, didn't get paid as much, but that was going to be their career eventually once they had enough training and they were trying to get out of the restaurant industry. All those people gone for good, you know. Yeah. It was about 20% of my staff, at least with the higher skill positions, right? Like food runner, Javier is like the best food runner in the game, best to ever do it, in my opinion. And that's a skill of its own. Mm. But, you know, as much as I wanted him to become a server and try to train him up, he never was interested. And, you know, it would have been hard for him to just language barrier wise.
He should move to Miami.
Get to that point.
Miami, everyone speaks Spanish.
Yeah, so that's true. He likes Atlanta. Yeah. He had some kids here, so he's been here for a long time. And I don't think he wants to do that. He just likes running food, you know? And to be honest with you, my favorite job I ever had was running food.
So running food is just taking the food to the table from the kitchen?
From the kitchen to the table. You've never seen customers so happy.
Yeah.
You know, that's when they get their food. That's the happiest they are all night. So
yeah, that's true.
So you get to see them then, and I love that job. I only had it for a month, but I really did like that job. You don't get paid enough though, so it's hard to do. But yeah, so about 20-25%, I would say, of the whole industry left permanently or semi-permanently.
Yeah, the only reason why it's somewhere in between semi-permanently and permanently is that a lot of people are not coming back because they found something else to do during this past year. And the next generation is not yet trained. So it actually is a little bit more than a semi-permanent problem.
Yeah, and there's a lot. I mean, the restaurant industry does not look good right now.
Yeah, so nobody's like saying, boy, I can't wait to go get back to food running. Because you don't even know if 2 weeks from now there's not going to be a third wave and everything's going to close down again.
Yeah, and if I'm 22 or 23 coming out of college, or if I'm 20 and in college, I don't really want to work in a restaurant right now. Like, it was fun because you got to party with everybody afterwards, you got to eat good food. You know, it's just not the same. It's not the same. It's just not the same like lifestyle. Even, you know, we all go to work now. We're wearing masks all the time. I don't even know what my coworkers really look like.
Yeah, right. So it's harder
it's
to
totally different than when I started.
So how does this affect? Obviously, hiring is important, but what are the nuances?
So the nuances are, these businesses make money. We have $3-4 million a year. Yeah, I know the margins are a little slimmer than a lot of other industries, especially with steakhouse type of food. You know. Food cost is pretty high. The building, you know, it takes a lot of money to run it. The biggest problem that exists is it was never a profession. It was a job. And I mean, when I started serving, my grandpa stopped talking to me. You know, he didn't want me to be in restaurants. He passed away and it was sad for me because we didn't have a great relationship at the end, even though we had a great relationship for most of my life. Because he was so adamant that I not go into restaurants.
Wow.
And I loved it. And I saw the potential. I see the potential now. I saw it then. I was like, this is just poorly run. You know, he said, it's a cash business. You can't trust employees. You know, don't ever go into that because everybody's going to steal from you. That's true to this day. You know, bartenders are stealing. I mean, not in my jobs currently, but I still know it to be a fact in the industry. It draws a certain type of crowd because it is a kind of gig industry.
Yeah.
It is super fun. There is a high level of mastery of all these different skills. And, you know, you can have some autonomy depending on what you're, you know, all the things that I think make a career great or exciting or make me want to do it. I think they can exist pretty easily with some pretty, you know, not huge changes, but everybody's just kind of stuck in the ways that they think about hiring. So for example, at my at my current job, this place called the Chastain. It's an amazing restaurant. Chris Grossman is like the most highly touted chef to come out of Atlanta in the last 20 years, probably. Super talented guy. Yeah, Chris Grossman. The Chastain is where he's at now. He was at Atlas. Another restaurant called Aria, both fine dining in Atlanta. He was at the French Laundry in between. So he's got some serious chops. And now he's a partial owner of the restaurant. And, you know, they're doing the same stuff that every restaurant has always tried to do in terms of hiring. So they offer $100 as a referral fee, you know, for if you can get a server in or a bartender or whatever.
And how often do they need new people?
Always. I have not been there a day when they haven't asked me, hey, Jason, do you know anybody? Can I get a food runner? Do you know a server? We're looking for 5 cooks.
So if they had like a software solution where instead of saying, hey, Jason, do you know XYZ and hoping to God that you do know someone who's available right then magically, if they had a software solution, they could at the very least also use that.
Yeah, I mean, they're using LinkedIn, they're using Indeed, they're using Facebook, they're using every method they possibly can think of. These are very good paying server jobs. Very good paying, like $200-$300 a night for 7 hours of not super hard work, which is pretty solid in this industry.
Oh my God, the menu looks great.
Yeah, it's killer.
Oh killer. Man, I want this potato and bacon crusted Georgia Mountain trout.
That's his specialty dish.
Really? Oh, I love that. I love the sound of that.
Yeah. We do like this. There's a 22, it's not on the menu. It's like a 24-ounce dry age ribeye.
Why does he crust it with potato as opposed to breadcrumbs?
It's a good question. I'm still learning the menu a little bit. I started there not too long ago and I haven't served there yet, but that is a good question that I will find out the answer to.
So interesting. Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours. And they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Save big money at Menards. Get your garden ready with groundbreaking power equipment from Earthquake. Tillers are great for breaking up compact soil and killing weeds in your garden. Get maximum power in a compact frame with a Pioneer rear tine tiller. It features dual direction tines and self-propelled steel wheels. Hurry in for all of your lawn and garden needs and visit Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
All right, so let's think about this. Like, what is a software solution? Like what would be better than Indeed? I mean, the problem with Indeed or LinkedIn is that you're running into a billion people when you're trying to find 10 out of a billion people who want a job as a waiter in Atlanta.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like a structural issue more so than a access kind of issue. It doesn't feel like it's a problem with the matching process as much as it's just like a problem with the job itself.
What do you mean?
I don't know why anybody would want to just become a server now.
Yeah.
You know, and there's just not enough servers to fill all the positions. People don't want to switch without guarantees. You know, I could tell somebody, hey, you can make $300 here a night instead of the $220 you're making. They may believe me, they may not. But they're not willing to switch from their 220 and the off chance that I'm lying or wrong.
Yeah.
So it's hard. It's a hard number. You know, it's hard to guarantee. They know that the second, let's say, God forbid, there's a variant that makes the vaccine useless and we have to go back, they know what's going to happen and everybody will be, you know, back on furlough, and hopefully the government does the right thing. It's just kind of a shitty, I don't know.
Yeah, and the government, there'll be a pressure at some point that the government can't do it forever. Structurally, there's a breakdown in the system itself, like how people choose to be in the system and then discovery of those people who choose to be in it. So is there a solution?
I think so. I think, you know, professionalize it, make it a career instead of a gig. And I don't actually know this, but maybe you could, I'm sure you have some insight. When other industries have a lack of workers, do they try to branch out from people that, servers don't need to be, they don't need to be servers. You know, if I could get maybe car salesmen or, other type of salespeople to become servers, I'm sure other industries have done that. I know real estate agents are often former servers.
Yeah.
Why can't we get real estate agents to become servers? Why is it always one way? It's always people leaving restaurants to go to do other things.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is, like, take real estate agents. Real estate agents are, and many professions are licensed. Are, like, to be a waiter, there's no license, right?
Yeah. Well, and most of them, yeah.
And so
you need a pouring permit.
I wonder if you can create some kind of hierarchy, some sort of licensing system, so that someone's always a waiter once they're a waiter, because they've gotten their second degree certificate and they go back for continuing education somehow. And so there's so there's always a list to draw upon, because you know who all the certified people are, because it's an industry now. It's a licensed industry. I wonder, would people be interested in, hey, get your, stand out above the rest, get your, restaurant certificate so you could work in the restaurant industry and at any time. You're first in line in the restaurant industry.
Yeah, and I love that idea. And I thought that should be a thing for a long time, because, I think, but right now, nobody would ever go to become a,
yeah,
go to any school to be a server, because you can just get any job you want. There's no barrier now. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. Like, that should be a thing, and you should, and restaurants should agree to pay more for those people, but restaurants don't pay anything for servers as is now.
How many email addresses do you have, just from your own personal connections and stuff, of people who you know are servers?
How many email addresses of servers do I have?
Yeah.
Ooh. Honestly, probably not a ton. 50?
Okay.
So 7, maybe 100. But
so what if I'm just thinking out, I haven't thought through this idea at all. What if you were to email all those 50 people and say, listen, I want to build a list for the restaurant industry, which is about to come back strongly, of all the servers in the industry I know. And so this way it's easy for them to find jobs once the jobs are needed. And then I'm also going to go to all the restaurant owners and, on a regular basis, see what jobs they need. Cause I feel like and you're just being totally honest with the people you email. So you email these 50 people and you say, can you email all the servers you know and ask them to send me an email? So this way, then, let's say you go from 50 email addresses to 1,000, hypothetically. I'm just making this up. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
You might need to have incentives for them to do it. So we could think about that down the road. Like, maybe they get cut in on the referral fees, depending on, almost like a multi-level marketing thing, but not as schemey. Like, maybe there's a way to track how people are coming to you. But you basically just put together a list. And since every restaurant owner needs servers every day, you go to the restaurant owners and say, listen, I know what you're doing. You're using Indeed.com. So you're hitting software engineers and trying to find servers. Well, I have a list of 12,000 servers in the Atlanta area, and I know who has jobs and at what restaurants and where they worked. And when you need a job, I'll place it and I'll do half your referral fee that you usually give. So $50 instead of $100. So I'm just thinking out loud of, like, something manually you can do that could later be automated as software.
Yeah. So, I like it. I do like the idea.
And then just to add to that, once they're on your list, you could send out content, you know, every other day or every day, like, oh, you know, this restaurant, they're looking at opening up another place in, you know, this area, or in this restaurant, they just switched their menu. Here's the old one. Here's the new one. Which one do you like better? You know, let's take a poll, anonymous poll. Like, I wonder if you could have like ongoing content and also create a Facebook group around it so they could communicate with each other. Or maybe you don't want to do that because then it might be too much. Well, maybe you do, maybe you don't. I don't know.
Well, there are like some type. I mean, we have that Giving Kitchen Facebook page that's for specifically for Atlanta, where a lot of service industry people kind of communicate on a whole bunch of different issues, post, you know, different things. But I wonder, the problem is, you know, everybody that wants to leave a restaurant is always scared to leave that restaurant because they kind of know how much money they make consistently. And they're worried that the next place they go, they're going to be the low man on the totem pole.
Right. But you're also telling me a lot of people are servers, but don't currently have serving jobs, or maybe they have suboptimal serving jobs. So if you have a list of not 50 people, but 10,000 people, some of those 10,000 are not only ready to work, but they're also good at their job. They weren't just like fired from their last 10 jobs. They're actually good. And so when you have like a list of 10,000, you're much more likely to avoid those problems.
Okay.
I would think.
Yeah.
Like, so many on those 10,000, let's say 80% of them will be satisfied with their jobs and they're not going to leave unless there's a significant pay increase. But you increase the chances that you won't have to do a pay increase if you have a list of, if you have a higher supply and the demand stays the same, value sort of goes down or stays the same. So you don't have to, the restaurant owner won't have to increase the pay. And I know part of this is to ideally increase the pay, but you're also going to have on your list people who are professionals and that might just naturally increase the pay.
Right. Okay.
So I'm just thinking, I'm just...
Do you think, yeah. I guess I hadn't really thought about... like trying to be the link in the networking.
I'm wondering if this is just an experiment to see if manually, if this works, and then you can automate it. You know, so Craigslist, you know, Craigslist started by this guy, Craig Newmark. He basically sent out an email to his friends. Hey, here's the things happening in San Francisco this week. And they emailed it out to a bunch of people. And then people started signing up for his list. And then he added, oh, here's the apartments for rent in San Francisco. Here's this, here's that. And then he started doing it in every city and he automated it all. He's not involved at all in the company. It's still called Craigslist. Same thing happened with another company called Angie's List, which is worth something like $400 million. And Craigslist was worth billions now. And I wonder if you just start off manually, but then once you see that, okay, people seem on both sides of the equation, the sellers and the buyers, they're excited. And then you can automate it. And, you know, a typical business model, almost every business could be thought about this way, actually. But a great business way to think about business is somebody, some group of people have enormous excess of something. They have, for instance, they have many empty bedrooms in their house. And then other people want access to that excess. So I'm traveling to Tennessee. Let's say I'm traveling to Nashville. I need to stay in one of these extra rooms because all the hotels are booked. The business is the platform in the middle, whether it's a human or a software system. So Airbnb matches people who have an excess of rooms to people who want access to those rooms. Uber matches people who have an excess of empty car seats to people who want access to those car seats in a specific area at a specific time. And all these businesses can be started manually to test the idea, but then you quickly move to a software solution.
Yeah.
The trick is getting people to sign up on both sides.
Right. That's the hardest part.
Well, I mean, there are other hard... So the reason why there's a platform in the middle is you handle it's a safe way to handle the transaction. So I don't have to deal directly with the owner of a house and then he rips me off, or the owner of a car or whatever. And, you know, so there's some mediation and there's some security issues taken care of. So the platform's important. Like, everybody wants to know this is a secure platform. The owners want to know I'm getting good people. The people want to know I'm getting into a good restaurant and I could trust the situation. And, you know, so that's, you know, but then how do you get people to sign up? Like, how does Uber win over Lyft? Some of the incentives are monetary. Some of it is the larger you are, the more people will sign up with you because that's how you get business. And so it kind of feeds on itself. There's like a network effect. And the same, you would have the same kind of network effect. So then the initial thing is, how do you get that initial bunch? But you get the initial bunch just because you know the people on both sides and you could think of the right language and the right incentives, or you could experiment a little bit to figure out how to get people to share what you're doing so that other people sign up, both on the owner side and on the server side.
Okay. So I'm trying to think about how to ask this in terms of like Airbnb or something similar. So Airbnb, you have the people that have extra rooms or whatever, and then you have people that need a room. So the people that need a room are more like the servers, and the people that have the extra rooms are more like the employers in this analogy.
Yeah. So the, no, actually it's the other way around. So the employees have an excess of basic restaurant skills, and the owners need to, they need some restaurant skills working in their restaurant. So the owners are the ones who actually need the excess.
Yeah. That makes way more sense. Okay. So what happens when the renters need the room, right? So the owners need the employees and there's just not enough rooms. Price goes up, right?
So the owners need servers and there's not enough servers. So yeah, they would be willing to pay more.
Well, sticking with the Airbnb model, right? People that want to rent a space, there's a lot of them, and the people that have the rooms, there's not as many.
Right.
Think of like a big event happening in a smaller town.
Right. So people would be willing to pay more.
Except they're not. They're just unwilling to. And then all they do all day long is complain about how there's no rooms. That's what's happening now.
But what will happen to the restaurant in the long run if that continues?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the problem I'm interested in. It's that's what's happening now.
So, but if there could be a system like this, though, allows for short-term spikes in pay and which could come down when business goes back to normal. Because you can say, look, I'm willing to pay $300 if I could just get someone on New Year's Eve working. Because, you know, I know my liquor sales are going to be through the roof. So there could be short-term spikes when they need more people. And there's not enough people available.
Right. So they might do something like that for like a day or two or whatever. And that might be a thing, like a temp agency for restaurants could be that could be a thing. But most people don't want that even, you know, because it is so specialized and by restaurant to restaurant, you know? Yeah. So like if I'm a great server and you want me to go to the Chastain to be a server for a really busy night, and then I get asked, well, what's with the trout? And I don't have the answer. Like, I just didn't have the answer.
Yeah.
You know, that's a problem, right? So, so it's hard to like get all the intricacies of, you know, a restaurant. It's not like I could have a temp do a host position, right? Mm-hmm. But when it comes to all the products that you need to know to be a server, training takes like at least a week.
So what's the ideal scenario of a system? So an ideal would be restaurant owners would be willing to pay up for quality, for instance.
Yeah, but not even, I don't know what my ideal is. I'm just, all I'm saying is I'm seeing that this, you know, there's way more demand for servers than there are actual servers at this point. And there's an unwillingness from restaurants to change the model at all. And so something's going to have to give at some point.
Yeah.
There will be enough pain to create change at some point. And so, maybe we haven't hit that yet, but it's coming.
So we don't know yet. We know this is a big problem. We know you're an expert at it. So it does seem like worth looking into further. So it's a valid spoke. So there's two things we could do. One is just we could put a pin in that and start exploring the next spoke. So we're going for breadth rather than depth at this point, figuring out a bunch of viable things and then starting to see which ones we can explore a little further. I would say the one extra thing we can do here is send out an email, or you could think about how to do this and we could brainstorm this even next time, but how can we send out an email to your friends who are all servers and say, hey, I'm collecting the email addresses of basically every good server in Atlanta. And I only want, and I'm sending you an email because I think you're a great server. And I know you know how to analyze who else is a great server. Have them send me an email of all the good servers. And then you can make that same offer to those people who sign up. And you can even set up a website. And I could show you how to do that really easily. There's plenty of sites where you could do that within 5 seconds. You can even set up a website to start collecting all the email addresses. And you could send out all these emails through that website. And so it collects everything through one ecosystem. And then you later on, you could migrate the email list somewhere else if you choose to. So that's one experimental way we can just start finding out the list of people who have the excess.
Yeah, I can definitely do that.
Like, let's brainstorm on that, because I think that's worth doing. Because at the very least, an email, let's say magically, you have an email list of 10,000 people in the Atlanta area or in Georgia area who are good servers, and it's 10,000. That email list is going to have more value than just for hiring. For instance, you might be able to sell them a course on, owning a restaurant if they want to make that transition, or you might be able to send them a newsletter that has ads in it about the restaurant business. And then restaurant owners who need servers, or restaurant owners who simply want to advertise, can advertise in your newsletter.
Yeah.
Or you could potentially offer a higher end product that people would be willing to pay for. And you could do the same thing on the restaurant owner side. Like, you could say, hey, I'm putting together this email list of all servers. If you're interested in communicating to my list, you can sign up, and it's a $100 a month subscription or a $50 a month subscription, something. And you can have a separate list of restaurant owners, and they'd be willing to pay because it's so valuable to them to have access to 10,000 servers. So
yeah, that's great.
So
and it makes a lot of sense too, because I'm like, I feel like I'm, and I think you picked up on it without me realizing it, but like, there's more value in these, the really good quality people, than what they're currently valued at. So I see,
right,
like there's upside for them regardless of how, you know, whether it's getting them in front of the right employers or being able to send them information about restaurants and somehow advertise to them. But
right, because if someone's a good server, a lot of their friends who are not in the restaurant business are going to ask, hey, what's a good new hot restaurant to eat at?
Right.
Like,
they're influencers.
Like, I bet you get asked that more than I get asked that. No one ever asks me, what's a good restaurant to eat at? But how many times a month would you say someone asks you, what's a good restaurant to eat at?
100 at least. I mean, I talk about it all the time at my restaurant.
Right. So I get asked 0 times. So there's definitely,
yeah,
because you are a professional at this, and people recognize that there is a quality spectrum in it, then we just proved it. I get asked 0 times, you get asked hundreds of times. I'm at one end of the spectrum, you're at the other end of the spectrum. So it makes sense there should be this one difference. There probably isn't a difference in how many people ask us, hey, what's a good sports event I can go to this weekend? It's probably little spectrum difference there, but huge spectrum difference.
Yeah, roughly 0, yeah.
Yeah, so you get asked 100 times, I get asked 0. So having that list even makes you more, like, I always try to think, with a business, okay, Google has $1.5 trillion value. And how can I do what Google does will I have $1.5 trillion value? Well, I can't do what Google does, but here's what I can do. If you ask me anything, like, James, do you have any ideas about a book I could write? I could say, well, I don't really, but here's how I would think about it. And here's 10 ideas I've been thinking about. Why don't you see if that works? And if I just generally live my life that way, as if I were like this personal Google, it will create monetary value for me. Like, maybe not $1.5 trillion, but maybe $1 million or $5 million or whatever. And so, or LinkedIn, if you're always asking me, hey, I have a friend who needs a job. Do you know anyone? And I reach out to people I know and say, hey, do you know anyone who knows anyone who has a job available for this guy? And I'm good at that. So I'm like a mini LinkedIn. Again, who knows where the value will be, but I'll probably get some of the $20 billion value of LinkedIn that to accrue to myself personally. So when you act like these high value companies, even personally, it creates value. So what I'm saying is, even manually, if we figure out how you can make this list on both sides, and so you sort of like perform almost like a personal Airbnb type business or personal restaurant specific LinkedIn business, that's automatically some value that accrues to you personally. And then if you productize it by turning it into a software system or automating it in some way, then that actually becomes a real business.
Okay. But the first step is to, you know, make it a micro version of one of these successful companies and not necessarily worry about monetizing it like immediately.
Right. Definitely not about, but monetizing it can happen pretty quickly, but you don't want to think about monetizing it immediately.
Sure.
So, I mean, as an example, I don't know if you follow, or maybe I told you this story, but Charlemagne the God, he's a radio host, like an urban.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
So I sent him a bunch of ideas about a book he should write. He said, let's do it together. And I resisted at first, but we ended up doing it. It was released the other day, and it's like the best-selling book on Audible right now. And I didn't get paid anything. But if there's opportunities down the road that comes from that, I'll get paid. And if I do that constantly in my life, like sending these ideas out to people, ultimately I make a lot of money. And that's actually what has happened. And so, but some things can happen faster than others. Like Craigslist monetized pretty quickly, Airbnb monetized pretty quickly. But I think the list itself has more value even than the initial business idea. We might not even know the right business idea until after you have the list. And so then that's why I'm just thinking the brainstorming here really is, how do you, I think because you're trusted in the industry and you know a bunch of people who are trusted, that's the first step in getting a rather big list. Okay, let's put a pin on that. And okay. I think that's a good idea to manually at least experiment with. And
Perfect.
Then
yeah, I can do that.
The other thing is then I would start thinking of like another spoke that you think is really interesting right now to do or explore. Like you want to have, let's say, 5 or 6 spokes identified, and then we can really figure out what are the best ones to choose, or maybe all the ones are worth taking the next step. That's the good thing about going for breadth and a little depth, is that we don't have to have a full business plan. We just have to have a first step on 5 different ideas and
sure.
See what happens. It's like we're fishing, and we have 5 fishing lines, and we see which one catches a fish, or maybe multiple fishing lines catch a fish.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match 2 of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Remember how I was telling you like the lack of communication between the reservation system and the point of sale?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's like too super time sensitive, specific to like kind of what's going on in the world now. Although I think it is bit like it is just kind of an interesting piece of the restaurant puzzle that is kind of underutilized. So I was talking to one of the servers that I used to work with that I now work with again at the Chastain. She was telling me that they're supposed to write, so they get the reservation system, you know, James coming in at 7 o'clock. All right, we're going to put him at table 41. We drag him on the iPad to that table. Immediately, once he gets placed there, let's call it like a dupe or a chit, gets printed. It says your name. It says, you know, maybe you told the host that you're allergic to shellfish and it's your birthday today and we're celebrating your birthday. So the host will go over to the server, say, hey, this is table 41. You know, here's your chit. Server will read it and say, okay, great. Most of the time they don't really care unless it's a VIP or a birthday or anniversary or something that they need to be aware of, or obviously dietary restriction. But if it's like, a lot of times it'll say it wants to sit indoors and then the server doesn't give a fuck because, all right, they're already indoors. There's nothing important on this. And so what the Chastain is trying to do is getting their servers to put notes on all of the chits and hand them in at the end of the night for the manager with the detailed notes about the table. So like what they like to order, what their temperament was like, if they were like fun and casual or if they were buttoned up and serious, you know. I asked the server, I was like, so how's that working out? She said, I'm pretty sure I'm the only server that's doing it and I'm not doing a very good job of it. And I said, oh, why is that? She goes, it's just so hard to like, you know, remember something I'm used to doing. The management doesn't really like force us to turn them in at the end of the night, doesn't kind of like make, you know, a huge focus. It's just something that they'd like to do, but it's such a great idea.
Yeah.
And it's kind of silly that they have to do it so manually when both the point of sale is already a computer and the reservation system is already a computer. You have to have this human taking notes on a piece of paper so that it can go from one to the other.
So the reservation system has the chit itself has in data form already, all these notes. And we already, at the point of sales, we know what they ate. So that's the stuff we all know. Now, temperament, we don't know, but that might not be as important. Like the first step might be, you know, what do they eat? So if they ate a dessert wine, for instance, you know, the server could potentially upsell them another, more expensive dessert wine. Or if they didn't have a dessert wine when they should have, that's something the server can see.
Yeah, and if they had a dessert wine, make sure you ask them if they would like a dessert wine. Because a lot of times people aren't just going to order it on their own. But if you ask, if they're prompted, then they will.
Yeah, particularly if the last time they ate there, they had one. They could even say, like, you know, I know I was told you ordered dessert wine. You know, if it's not creepy, I don't know how to do it. But if I was told you ordered dessert wine last time, we just got a new shipment of blah, blah, blah. Would you like to try that?
Or yeah, and pair them with the same server again. So, hey, I remember last time you were here, you got a dessert wine. Even if you don't actually remember, you know that it happened because you have it there. And they're like, wow, I can't believe you. What a great memory.
Yeah. And so I wonder if, so right now, what happens to the point of sale data? Do you save that?
So I'm most familiar with Aloha, one of the more for like fine dining type of restaurants. And that data is saved forever. Toast is the same way. I mean, you can search, you can go back months and see what was years and see what was on the table 41 at the first turn. And then if you have the reservation system, you can see who was actually sitting there. So if you had enough time in your day, you could go through and do all of that for sure.
So let's see. Aloha, I'm looking them up right now.
And actually, the people that started Aloha own the Chastain.
Really?
Or at least a part of the venture fund that.
So it's just point of sale solutions.
I think they have Lighthouse now too. They bought a couple of different I think roughly that's pretty similar.
So they do have like restaurant loyalty programs.
Aloha does?
Yeah, they have online ordering systems. They have kitchen production software. So send out fresh, high-quality food fast with kitchen production software and hardware designed by the best in the business. They have consumer engagement with drive brand loyalty and reward your best customers with restaurant loyalty, store value. But it doesn't look like they don't have anything that connects to reservation systems.
I've done some research on it, and maybe there is something, but I have yet to see that communication between a reservation system and a point of sale.
So, but you're right. They do have, in digital format, in some probably easy to store way, data on everybody who goes to a restaurant. They know their name. They know what they ordered. They know how loyal they are. And separately, we have
a reservation. They don't know the name.
Oh, they don't know the name. How do they reward your best customers?
I have no idea. You said that, and I was like, that's news to me.
So how would you connect the restaurant reservation system to the point of sale, or at least the data, like manually? How would you do it?
How I would do it? So if I had infinite time, so I would grab my iPad with all the reservations on it. Mm-hmm. I would take it to the back of house terminal. Mm-hmm. For the point of sale, and I would click on table 41. James, you're my first reservation that night. You came in at 5:30. I would look on my back of house point of sale and see your table. I can see everything you ordered, and I can manually input it into the reservation system under your name.
And now, is this only important for restaurants that have repeat customers?
Yes.
Or do you think restaurants would share the information with each other with the idea to get more?
They should, but they, I don't know. They probably would feel, they're so competitive that most of the time they feel like, well, I got the data. I don't want to share it with my competitor. Even though, you know, if both of them were sharing, it would benefit both of them. They don't really do a ton of like cross promotion in general. Sometimes they do. And there definitely are certain chefs that like to work together better. But when it comes to like the business stuff, they usually stay pretty separate.
But like, for instance, like I own a comedy club. If other comedy clubs at like the level of my comedy club say to me, hey, we'll share all our customer data about what comedians the customers show up for and what they order and so on, if you share yours in a common database, would I do it? I think I probably would do it, actually.
Yeah, but you're much more forward-thinking than most restaurateurs.
Okay, so here's another thing. What if not only do you combine all this data, so you have it just in case there are a lot of repeat customers, but what if the restaurant then follows everybody on Instagram and tries to friend them all on Facebook and follows them all on Twitter? Because you'll probably be able to find most of them because it's John McEnroe, who lives in Atlanta, and you'll see what he looks like, and you might recognize him or whatever. And, or there might be only one John McEnroe in Atlanta who seems like the type of person who would go to your restaurant. So you can make some social media outreach too, to each one of them after they've been to the restaurant.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't say no. They'd probably feel honored that, hey, they're a special friend of the restaurant now.
Yeah. I mean, I did that personally. I have plenty of Facebook friends that I met in the restaurant, something that should be done for sure.
So I think that's another spoke. And as opposed to like making an entire software system, I think there is some benefit to you doing something manually. It doesn't have to be the infinite thing, but you should be doing something manually and adding a social media component to maybe drive back second visits and then seeing if matching this data or the point of sales to the reservations can increase the check value. And I bet you that could be manually done. And the owner of the Chastain might even be willing to do it just to see. And you could say you're not charging anything. You just want to see if you can increase their revenues. Why would they say no to that?
Yeah. With following through social media.
Yeah, or some because your data only works if you get second visits. So the social media will help you get the second visits.
Oh, and well, Chastain has no problem with second visits.
Okay, I see.
They are all second visits, third visits, fourth visits.
You know what also, though, is here's the other thing. And this is actually an interesting idea, which I haven't really used in practice, but I wonder if anyone has. But once you know someone's name, let's say John McEnroe goes to the Chastain, spends a lot of money, so he's a great customer, and he ordered the bacon-crusted trout. And what if you can make a Google ad where you target his name? So everybody does a Google search on their own name. And so they'll see a targeted ad just to them. It won't cost any money because it's hardly ever going to, the ad's hardly ever going to show. It's only going to show if his name shows up or if he Googles himself. And what if you say an ad, whenever he Googles himself, he sees an ad from the Chastain. Hey, you know, we're trying extra, you know, honey glazed bacon, you know, on the new menu item, a special on the trout today. With the honey glazed bacon and some other stuff and blah, blah, blah. And so so that might be an interesting way to test even getting more visits from people who don't do second visits that much.
That's interesting. Does everybody Google themselves?
I mean, I probably do at least once or twice a day.
But you have things that pop up about you.
Yeah. So maybe that's a special case. I don't know.
But maybe that's a thing. I don't know. If I had things popping up about me, I would definitely Google myself all the time too.
Or you could just target the entire list. The Chastain has a new menu for this week, you know, special holiday menu for this week only. The chef is using his latest Parisian experiment or whatever. I don't know. And it goes to everybody who's ever been to the restaurant because you have all their names.
Yeah. And we have all their email addresses too.
Yeah. So you could send that out. Now, sometimes you have to get permission to, there's rules about that, but, to send them an email, but sometimes yes, sometimes no, particularly, well, here's what you could do though. If you become Facebook friends with all of them, then you could totally just put something on your Facebook feed and promote it to your friends. And that's your friend, the restaurant's friends or their customers.
Right.
So then that's actually the cheapest way to do it. So I think there's something there. So that's like a second spoke and a second step for that spoke, which the second spoke is kind of connecting point of sales data with reservation data. And the step for it is manually at least put together like the next 1,000 customers who eat there and see what you could do with them to increase revenues over the next 2 months. And then you can actually document, oh, revenues went up 50%, even seasonally. And so you can have a track record and a testimonial, and then you can figure out what the next step is after that, which is either restaurants sharing data or a software system, or, you know, there's a bunch of possible next steps after that.
Yeah. So, and then the other thing too, with that spoke, so right now the Chastain's issue is not getting people in. Well, they don't really have that many issues, but they have the bigger issue that they have space that they can't use because they don't have enough servers, but that's from the first spoke.
Right.
But when they bring people in, we say no to so many people. So it's not like trying to attract more people necessarily, but to upsell them so that the check average is higher. So maybe right. Specifically like targeting, well, James just came in, he bought an $120 bottle of Cabernet. Let's target him somehow to try to sell him this $150 Cabernet.
So there's two ways to upsell in this case. One is when they come in for the second visit, because you said a lot of second visits happen, you know, either you do this manually or you figure it out, but you'll know, let's say you have the infinite time and you're there. You know, hey, you say to the server, hey, I want you on this guy because you served him last time. I want you to say this. And you give her the line or him the line to say that upsells it. And you see how often that works. The other thing is that if you know a bunch of people on your list, like the $120 wine, and you happen to have $150 wine, you could say some way or other, somehow you target them outside when they're not in the restaurant, and say, hey, we just got this really high-end, you know, $160 wine of this. You know, it's the version that you're pretty sure you could upsell them. And then they might even come in for an extra visit just because you've got this wine.
Right.
So there's a couple of ways to upsell. And then you could always downsell from the upsell. So if, like you say, listen, you have 120, I remember you had the 120, you had this wine last time. You don't say the dollar amount, I guess.
Yeah.
This wine last time. We just got in this very special one from the Swiss Alps, whatever. And then they say, nah, I think I'll stick with the other one. And you can say, that's fine. But just so you know, even with the other one, we got this one vineyard that only puts out a new wine every 3 years. And it's from the same region. You like that one. And you might want to try that. So you could downsell from the upsell.
Nice. Yeah.
And still upsell from their old one.
From the old one. Right. So here's a $150 one. You don't want that, but let's, okay. Well, instead we have this $130 one, which is still higher than the 120.
Right.
So
like every sale has an upsell and a downsell, and every upsell has an upsell and a downsell. So you could just, you could always try to apply that as much as possible to every sale. Like for instance, I sell a newsletter. So let's say it's called the Altucher Daily Newsletter. And I sell it for a year for $50. As soon as someone purchases that, they see a message that at the online shopping cart, they say, listen, we can purchase this. By the way, you just spend $50 for 1 year. For $100, you could get this for a lifetime. So for just 2 years worth, you can get it for a lifetime. And they're like, nah, I'm just going to try it for a year. So now they get the downsell from the upsell. Like, hey, would you also like to buy his book? It's $10. In the bookstore, it's $16, but we'll sell it to you for $10. And so that's the down, you know, the downsell from the upsell. Now, if they get the lifetime report, you could say upsell then. Listen, James has some high-end newsletters. You want to check them out? Like, he has one for selling stock options, and it's $3,000 a year, but, you know, because you just got the lifetime report, we'll sell it to you for $1,000. They could be like, yeah, I'll take it. And then the upsell from that is, hey, he's got 16 products like that for just $3,000, which is the price for any one of them. You can become an alliance member and get all of them for life. And the downsell from that might be lifetime for the more expensive high-end report they
got.
Does it ever end?
Is there?
Yeah. It ends at the most, it ends at the most expensive product, because then there's nothing left to sell. And even if they don't get the original newsletter for $50, maybe they buy the book for $10. And so at the very least, then you get $10 from, you might lose money on that, but you get their email address. And what we track is that over the years, just dealing with hundreds of thousands of customers, we know what the average email address is worth. So just getting an email address might be worth $30 for in lifetime value. So that means we'd be willing to lose, let's say, $20 or $15 in getting that email address.
Sure.
And the same thing, the same principles could apply to a restaurant, but they like to make money that second. But if they take a longer term view of just the value of just getting someone's email address and being able to communicate to them, they might be, yeah, go ahead.
How do you convince people to get the longer term view? That's what I'm struggling to do most of all. And I think that's like kind of the underlying thing of all of the spokes potentially.
That's very hard, because like I tried to explain to these, so I have this one business that sells newsletters, and they know what the value of an email address is. So they know what the value of an email address is who's not a subscriber. They know what the value of an email address is who's a subscriber of the cheap stuff. They know what the lifetime value is of an email address combined with they bought the higher end stuff. So I tried to convince them there's also a lifetime value to someone who listens to my podcast, even if we don't know their email address. So I was trying to convince them to market my podcast, but they just didn't see it because they had to calculate it. They had to have a method of calculating it exactly, and there was no way to do it. And I tried to figure out ways, and it wasn't their thing. It wasn't their business to figure that out. So you might not be able to convince people of that. But the main way is data. So if you start off with something simple, like what you were talking about, just manually connecting the point of sales with the reservation system, that's simple. And so they can, and you could show them, look, this guy came back, and instead of just coming back with his wife, he brought his group of friends. And instead of spending $100 a person, they spent $150 a person. You know, then the restaurant owner.
I know what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. I know how to test this.
Okay.
So on Resi, you can, let's say, Saturday's tomorrow. So I can see the reservations for Saturday. I can go through. I can see how many times every person has been there. Mm-hmm. And then I can click on them. I can see their history of when they showed up. And I can go back and I can collect previous data.
Ah, yeah.
For only the ones that have been there more than, like let's say 3 or more times.
Yeah.
See if I can use that data to increase their check averages for the following visit.
And you're friends with the servers, right? They're not going to be annoyed at you doing this. So you could basically say, listen, I want to put you on this guy and I want you to say these things. And if they say that, and come back to me with how they respond, and we'll kind of strategize throughout their meal. And so you'd have to be very active during the meal itself, I think.
Yeah. Well, I could try both. I could try being active during the meal, and I can try just having it on the dupe like it would be if I wasn't there.
Right, right. So,
like if it was automated, I wouldn't be there telling them what to do every time, but I can try both to see if one's better than the other.
Yeah. So let's see. So what are the factors? There's overall table, sales. There's sales per person.
Yep.
There's repeat visits. There's specifically, do they take the suggestions or not that you've come up with? Now, by the way, just because they don't take the suggestions, but the ticket sales are still higher, that might be a good outcome. Is that because maybe the server is making more suggestions, maybe they feel like they have more choices and they're willing to spend a little more. So you don't, even if they don't take the suggestions, offering the suggestions might be the value as opposed to them taking it.
Right.
So what's another factor that demonstrates success? I guess if they do a review.
Yeah.
What might be another factor?
Time between that visit and the next visit.
Yeah. So there's a couple ways you can measure success. Like at least, because the more ways you can measure success, the more ways you can convince the restaurant owner this is something of value. Like
right.
two or three of these aspects might be relevant to them. And I guess profits per table per visit, like they buy the more profitable items.
Which is hard because I don't.
But the restaurant owner might know. But okay, I throw it in there, but maybe
somewhat.
It's not
good. Yeah, no, I could, it would take a lot more communication and information than I have easy access to.
All right, so look, so now we have two spokes with 2 second steps. You don't have to do anything yet. Maybe just think about these things. But I think this starts narrowing in on what might be a way to monetize your extreme knowledge. Like, you're an example of someone who has excess of something and somebody else wants access to it. So you have an excess of restaurant knowledge on a wide variety of areas, that ranging from ownership and management to serving to being a customer. So restaurant owners in particular, but also maybe restaurant employees, might want to have access to your knowledge. So we're figuring out as many things as possible that you could be in the middle of, so people are willing to use you as essentially a platform and also share data with you. And then once we figure out the different spokes that work, that's the things you can scale. Like, okay, I need to hire a programmer for this, or I need to find a more scalable solution for this, and on and on.
Cool. And yes. Is that something that's even like possible to do, to program some device that can connect to both the reservation system and the point of sale?
Let me see.
Is that like something that can be even done?
Yeah. Let me see. There's an easy way to see. Yeah. So Resi, for instance, yes. The answer is yes, that you absolutely could do that. And what was the other system?
Is it API? Is that?
Yeah.
I don't know anything. Sorry.
API is the word.
The one we're using right now is called Revel.
Revel does have an API. Yeah. In fact, Revel has a whole blog on how restaurants can benefit from their API. So for instance, customer engagement, implementing an open API system is a key part of customer retention strategy. So by integrating CRM applications, so they're assuming a restaurant might have some database to keep track of all their customers. I don't know if such a thing exists or not, but they can say you can interface your database of customers, even if it's like an Excel spreadsheet, in using the API, you can integrate with Revel.
Okay, cool.
So that's essentially what you're doing. So we might find during the course of this that there are competitors, but competitors are okay. That it just shows that it's a valid business, that there's competitors. Right. And then the next step of knowing there's a competitor is figuring out at least one feature you can offer that they don't offer, which shouldn't be too hard given that you have a lot of knowledge. So yeah, these are two spokes. We'll think of more and then think of more how you can do these things manually. And let's talk again after we play next week.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.